Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And that makes it the Donald in the Kitchen. We get together here once a week on Tuesday in the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalon Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us around our kitchen table. This is Community Radio, and it's a wonderful organization that is made up of volunteers and people that love radio, and we get to talk about what we like to talk about. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Yes, we do, on the Donalana Kitchen. It's summer. It is summer, and the weather has sort of moderated, despite the fact that the rest of the world is
going up in flames.
Going up. Oh, my goodness. Here we are in the Midwest.
Where it's supposed to be hot.
And it's not. It's beautiful. We're having a lovely little
space. It's decent. I mean, it's warm, but it's really decent.
Oh, Donna, you expect this is a lovely summer day. It is. It is. I must mention two lovely things from Farmer's Market. I mean, there are things that you just kind of notice. Well, besides the fact that there's sweet corn there, and sweet corn is lovely.
There's everything there now.
Everything is
there. This is the everything is growing season.
Woohoo! I want to mention two notable things. Cherry rose sunflowers. They are the most beautiful things.
Oh, I thought, I'm looking at our notes, I thought you said ice cream, and then you put cherry rose sunflower. I'm going, cherry rose sunflower ice cream?
No. Two different things.
Okay.
First, the sunflower. The sunflowers were the prettiest, pinkest, little, most sexy-looking sunflowers
I've ever
seen.
They're about 4 or 5 inches across, and they have the typical yellow around the edge. And then they go into this rosy. They are gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Among everything else, gorgeous there. And, yes, I did want to mention ice cream, because nothing says breakfast at the farmer's market like a dish of ice cream. And I had a little bowl of grapefruit sorbet.
For breakfast?
I thought so. It was healthy.
Okay.
That's good. Anyway, good stuff there. And I want to mention, in the garden, tomatoes are coming and okra is coming. So hang in there, folks.
Okra. Oh, wow. We didn't have it. Now, I saw eggplant at the farmer's market, new potatoes.
Yes.
And the Onion Creek tomatoes. Dum-da-dum-da-dum.
Just kind of dribbling in. But, yes, tomatoes all over the place. And cucumbers. People have lovely cucumbers. So, enjoy summer. We like food. And there it is. Well, food, farming, and science. Agriculture has been doing things to make sure that we can feed ourselves for hundreds and thousands of years.
As long as we've been feeding ourselves.
Yes, we decided that we can grow things that we want to grow and breed for things. And the science of it all, I think science means that you try things out and
experiment.
And we learn from our mistakes.
So we're going to talk about the CRISPR technologies, but I have a copy in front of me of something called, Wired Magazine, fairly liberal publication. The cover story is "The Mutant Future of Food. Looks great, tastes fine, and just might save the planet." Okay, so.
Oh, wait a minute. First, spell CRISPR. We're not talking like the texture of an apple.
No. Okay, CRISPR tech. It's all in caps. CRISPER. And it is, okay, we're going to get a little geeky here, folks. So CRISPR technology is not the same as the GMOs, quite. In the GMO technologies, what they did is they went, it's called transspecies. So they took a gene from one species and put it into another one. which would never, ever, ever happen in nature. Okay, so with CRISPR, the newer, kinder, gentler GMO technology, is that what they're doing is they've invented a way to, as they put it, turn on and off certain genes. Now that we've sequenced a lot of the DNA for many, many, many species, they've figured out, the scientists have figured out how to go in and, like, turn off a gene that has a quality that they don't like that might cause it doesn't get ripe fast enough. Or the one, the apple one that's already out, is they turned off the gene that causes the apple to turn brown when you cut it, right?
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. So everybody's kind of high on all of this, but remember, it's very new. We really don't know what we're doing yet here. So what I wanted to talk about today, Dr. Charles Benbrook, whom we've mentioned before in the show, and his he's written a new paper. The title is Why Regulators Lost Track and Control of Pesticide Risks, semicolon, lessons from the case of glyphosate-based herbicides and genetically engineered crop technology. So what Chuck is talking about here, and let me just say that we have in the studio with us Chuck is somebody that I've known for many years as a scientist, and we have with us Dr. Fred Kirschemann, who's also a good friend of Chuck's, and we are reading with great interest his papers. And so Fred is going to comment on this issue after I've explained to you what is in Dr. Benbrook's paper. So what he's saying essentially is he's going over the history of the introduction of genetic modification into the agricultural system from the 90s on. And in America, this is not true globally, but in America, I think a good, maybe even greater than 90% of all of the cotton, corn, and soy, at the very least, have adopted this technology. So, you know, in a 30-year span, we have completely changed the genetic base of these major, major crops in our country. So what Dr. Benbrook is saying, and I'm just going to read this a little bit because it's very concise. So here we go, a little geekiness from his paper. The summary is, innovative policy changes are needed in four major problem areas. Then he says one of them is when we introduced the GMO technology, we had excessive faith in the accuracy of pre-market risk assessments and regulatory thresholds. And we also need changes in the post-approval mentoring of actual impacts and risks arising from formulated pesticides rather than just active ingredients. So what he's saying is when we first started and introduced them in the 1990s, one of the things that happened was there were the regulators put some brakes on certain of these things. Like, for example, there was they suggested that farmers could, for example, only spray the herbicide resistant, they could only plant those 2 out of 3 years because that cultivates resistance. And as we have seen, we now find that, you know, we've got all of these resistant weeds growing. So what in the 90s was a very effective technology for suppressing weeds and for suppressing pests, you know, we've got pesticides and herbicides. Okay, we just went gung-ho into it. Of course, the companies that are selling the product, they want to sell it every year. They don't just want to sell it 2 out of 3 years, you know. So after the initial phase of, say, 10 years where the government kind of was watching and, you know, we did apply some brakes to these technologies, but they were so largely successful in terms of marketing efforts and in terms of weed and pest suppression. Initially, of course, it really worked because the resistance hadn't kicked in. So the federal government just kind of stepped aside, dropped those cautionary things in, boom, you know, another 20 years later, we have some big problems with that. So what Chuck is saying in his paper is, you know, we need to take a step back, and there are certain scientific things that are very, very geeky that were not followed by the government. There are ways to watch out for this. And the reason I'm bringing this up right now is because in the media, there is now this huge push once again to justify the new CRISPR technologies. Now, they, like in this Wired magazine article, they paint a really rosy picture, as do the GMO technologies. They did paint that rosy picture for us. They continue to paint that rosy picture for us. However, we now know there are some issues here. So I just, as consumers, I know this sounds like a lot to digest. We need to be a little bit skeptical of these things. So, for example, the USDA has declared that the CRISPR technologies are not equivalent to the GMO technologies because they are not transgenic. They are not taking a gene from a fish and putting it into a tomato. So they are basically saying they are not going to regulate the technology at all. And in the European Union, they actually are going to rule on that this week. So we'll see how that comes out. Often the EU does not go whole hog in with these basically American technologies. So here's the issue. We're trying to fix our food system, with what Fred is calling control management rather than adaptive management. Fred, what are the alternatives to some of these things?
Yeah, well, let me first of all say I think that Chuck's paper is really important, and thank you for your clear explanation of it. And I think that his paper can make a contribution to the process that we're going to have to go through, because we are facing some problems within our agriculture and food system now that, in my view, is going to require some major kinds of transformations in the way in which we produce our food. But in the meantime, we need to think about alternative approaches like the one that Chuck mentions in his paper. But I think that it's important for us to go back into a little bit of history to understand where we are right now. And, you know, for the first 190,000 years that we humans evolved on the planet, we didn't do agriculture. We weren't food producers. We were food collectors.
Hunters
and
gatherers.
We simply went out into nature and collected food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to become food producers roughly about 10,000 years ago. And then in the 17th century is when the scientific revolution took place. And then several of the key scientists who were at the head of that revolution, like René Descartes and Francis Bacon, they felt that what we needed to do as humans is we needed to control nature. The way René Descartes put it, we had become the masters and possessors of nature. And the way Francis Bacon put it, we had to bend nature to our will.
Dominate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was this whole notion that we had to come up with the skills and the information to make nature do what we wanted her to do in our behalf and for our benefit. And then in the 18th century is when the Industrial Revolution began, and then we started to develop the technologies to, in fact, accomplish what René Descartes and Francis Bacon and others had had indicated. And then following on that, in the 1800s, there were some German scientists who came up with the idea that we needed to apply the law of the minimum. And Carl Sprengel, who first came up with that idea in 1828, and the idea was that if we're really going to be successful with our technologies, et cetera, we have to figure out how we get the maximum output for the minimum input. And then in 1840...
That sounds rather stingy, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then in 1840, Justus von Liebig applied that law of the minimum to agriculture in a document which he wrote called Organic Chemistry and Its Application to Agriculture and Physiology. And so he was the one who came up with, you know, all we have to really do with our technology is we find out how we can get the maximum output for the minimum input. And then what he came up with, what he discovered based on his own research, was that basically it's about NP and K, right? Nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash. A few others you add in, but those three are the main ones. And you simply put those three inputs into the soil, and then you get the maximum output. And then that became sort of the basic philosophy.
And it still is today.
For modern agriculture, right. Now, there were some individuals, going back to the early 1900s that took issue with that. And Liberty Hyde Bailey, who was our first secretary, one of our first secretaries of agriculture, he, in fact, published a book back in 1915 called The Holy Earth, in which he said this whole approach that we're using in agriculture, where we dominate nature and try to force nature to do what we want, is the wrong direction. What we really ought to do is treat nature like it was sacred and to learn from nature how we should be doing agriculture. But of course, by that time, the whole concept of the law of the minimum became so attractive that, very few people paid any
attention. It's a good marketing tool, I believe. Yeah.
And then, we could go through the list of all kinds of other people along the way. But one of the other ones that I think was really important, which I think gets to what we need to think about in terms of as we think about the future of agriculture now, and that was Aldo Leopold. And Aldo Leopold, of course, was an ecologist. And so he looked at how the whole life of nature functioned. And he came to the conclusion that one of the difficulties with the already almost 100 years ago, the direction we were moving in agriculture was what he called a density of species. And he said, if you really look at how nature functions, nature always abhors a density of any species.
That would be monocultures extreme density of species.
He didn't even apply it entirely to agriculture. He was simply talking about the way nature functions. And he said that nature always abhors a density of any species. So if any species reaches a density.
Well, that's right, including humans.
Including humans, right. If any species reaches a density which puts it out of that interdependent
balance,
which is how nature functions, it's always dependent on the various biologies of nature
and
supporting each other.
Right.
And if any species reaches a density which puts it out of that interdependent biotic community, what he called the land community, then nature will find a way to reduce that density. And then he added, he said, if one method fails, she will find another.
Right. There's that old saying. I think it's from the 60s. So, nature bats last. Yeah. Don't forget that.
Yeah. So if you look at what's happening in agriculture right now, that principle really applies, because right now one of the things that's happening is that, of course, with this direction that we've taken of the simplifying agriculture and reducing it through the law of the minimum, et cetera, is that we now have come to the conclusion that the way to be successful in our agriculture and food system is you simplify what you're producing and make it as specialized as possible, because that's what makes it the most efficient, and then you promote that as much as possible. And so when you look at, and I don't want to make this sound like I'm saying all of this is evil, it's just that it based on the way nature functions, the kind of agriculture that we have developed now, especially since the Second World War, because, this input-intensive system really didn't take off until after the Second World War. And part of what developed that was during the Second World War, so many of our manufacturing companies were developing the munitions for the war. And then when the war was over, what were they going to do? And then, of course, they discovered, based on the research that had already been done, that they could manufacture all of these fertilizers,
right,
et cetera. And then, of course, and they were cheap. And I still remember, I was growing up in the 1930s, and I still remember seeing photographs cartoons, basically, in local newspapers of a soldier standing alongside of a Model B John Deere tractor, which had a woman on it, because during the war, many of the women are doing the farming because the men were off to war. And there was a soldier with a bag of fertilizer over his shoulder next to the Model B John Deere tractor, basically telling the woman, this is the future of agriculture now.
what an image. There we go. And here we are. Yeah. Here we are so many years later.
Yeah. And so what we're discovering now, well, we're discovering basically two things. One is that this law of density is in fact into play. And so, you know, the kinds of things that Chuck talks about in his paper, which are, you know, some of the problems that we're seeing in agriculture.
Right. So let me just clarify for our listeners. The law of density means, for example, when you plant a monocrop you get so many of the same plant, and then you use the herbicides and the pesticides, pretty soon you start having negative results, which is weed resistance, pest resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what we're really struggling with here in Iowa and in all of farming communities
now. Yeah, and that's that law of density that Leopold already understood. You know,
and we know this is true in the technologies from the get-go. If you use the same herbicide and pesticide over and over and over again, those weeds get really smart, and they learn how to adapt and live with it.
Again, you know, Leopold said, if one method fails, nature will find another.
Mm-hmm.
And so the resistance is simply another way that nature has found to react to the law of density. Part of the good news here is that farmers themselves are now beginning to discover that this density and maintaining the density and enhancing it and coming up with new technology, whether it's CRISPR or whatever, to try to deal with the problems of it.
It's being called the pesticide and herbicide treadmill.
Yeah, yeah. And a few farmers, at least, are already beginning to understand now that no longer works for them economically. And a good example of that are the farmers that David Montgomery features in a new book that he just came out with last year called Growing a Revolution. And the subtitle is Bringing Life Back to Soil. And what he features are 8 different farmers who have been doing this kind of intensive input agriculture, and they realize they're losing money. So they knew they have to do something different. And so they're not all doing exactly the same thing, but they're applying the same principles. And that is that they they're no longer applying the law of the minimum. Well, what they're doing is looking at the biology of the system and trying to figure out, again, learning from nature, how they can farm in a way that will make them economically successful again.
And they're doing this by growing their soil,
Essentially what they're each doing, they operate on 5 principles, but the 3 things that mainly that they do is they reduce their tillage, because tilling soil to some extent, you know, causes harm to the biology of the soil, to the microbes in the soil. They add cover crops, because cover crops add the kind of diversity which adds to the health of the soil.
Feeds the soil,
and they significantly increase the biodiversity of their operation. So it's no longer monocultures of a few crops. It's, you know, more crops that are into the system. And then what they're finding as a result of these changes is that they dramatically reduce their input costs, so they start to make a profit now, and their soil improves to a point where the health of the soil is what provides the renewing capacity, and their farming system keeps improving on an economic basis as well as on a biological basis. So, you know, I'm not saying that this is a revolution yet, but it's growing a revolution, as David Montgomery points out.
Well, it also means that we do have the science to know how off of this herbicide pesticide treadmill.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the science is clear. There's a lot of evidence. There are There is literature which points out that there have been farmers, some for 100 years, that have already been farming by these principles and doing so successfully.
And they're still in business, yeah.
Yeah, but the major culture of agriculture is still locked into the
monoculture.
The monoculture and the law of density. And it's all about yield, right? But again, one of the things that's happening in order to get that yield, farmers are beginning to discover that it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to maintain it economically. And, as anybody who really looks at this economically, if it weren't for the kind of subsidies that we're providing to keep that kind of monoculture agriculture going, it already wouldn't be successful.
Well, and you may get a high yield, but if the price of what you're growing is dropping,
yeah,
your yield numbers could go up, but how much money you're making is going down. That's not
good your
business.
Cost, your cost. This is what the farmers in David Montgomery's point out. Their costs keep going up. Their returns keep going down, and so they keep losing money.
Well, and the reason the costs go up is because to buy the seeds and the pesticides and the herbicides, it's getting very, very expensive.
And here's the other thing that's happening. All of these inputs that we've been using, they are, a number of ecologists have pointed out, they are all based on old calories, that is, they're non-renewable resources. So, and if you just look at a few of them, fossil fuels, this system is enormously dependent on fossil fuels, not only for nitrogen, but for all of your energy, et cetera. It's dependent on rock phosphate, from which we get all of our phosphorus.
Let's talk about rock phosphate.
Okay, we'll get to the second.
Okay.
And then we're also using up our freshwater resources. Because we haven't paid attention to the health of the soil, we now use 70% of our fresh water on the planet just for agriculture irrigation. Now, if you just look at those three things, we know that we're using up our fossil fuels. We know that we're using up our fresh water resources. The Ogallala Aquifer, for example, which provides the irrigation water for the central part of the United States, now only has about, at most, 20 years of irrigation water left, and maybe only 10 years, depending on how rapid we take it out.
That could cause some changes.
And then the other example that you had wanted to get into is the phosphorus from which we get from our rock phosphate.
So that's the P from the NKP, very important in these systems.
There are only four countries that still have rock phosphate reserves. And again, experts who've been looking at this are also telling us that at most we only have rock phosphate reserves for another 20 years and maybe only another 10 years.
This is globally, yeah.
Now, you know that as these resources get depleted, the costs go up. In 1960, farmers were buying phosphorus for $60 a ton. Now it's $700 a ton. If we're going to deplete our rock phosphate reserves over the next 10 to 15 years, it could be $2,500, $3,000 a ton. At some point, it's not going to be affordable.
At some point, this is the point. It seems that this is the point that we have to look at the bottom line, and we'll come back and talk more about all these things that we're learning about what we've been doing in agriculture. This is KHOI 89.1. We'll come back. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. We are the Donalana Kitchen. We're at our kitchen table today with Fred Kirschman. We're talking about maybe learning a few things from our mistakes.
Fred is a farmer.
Yes.
He's also at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture and the Stone Barns. What's it called?
Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture.
There you go.
Yeah, it's time we kind of look at what we've been doing, because for many, many farmers and for many economies, our agriculture system is starting to show some wobbly bits.
Yeah,
a little wear
at the edges.
Yeah,
there.
I want to ask you, Fred, you were talking about all the inputs and all of the non-renewable inputs that we're putting in to grow our food. And I would like to ask, what have we done? Any damage, any long-term damage to the soil? That's pretty important stuff.
Well, yeah, if you just take Iowa as an example, and, you know, studies have been done recently by soil scientists in Iowa, and they're telling us now that since we've been doing conventional agriculture in Iowa, you know, basically since, on a large scale since the late 1940s, that we have lost over 6 inches of topsoil.
And that's our best asset.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's it going? Down the Mississippi?
Well, some of it goes down the Mississippi.
And they don't want it.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're not farming in a way that, one of the key issues here, from my perspective at least, are the microbes in the soil. You know, we still think about soil in our current culture as just being dirt.
Dirt, yep.
And so you got to put all the inputs in because it's just dirt.
It's just there to hold the plants up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But in fact, there are more microbes in a teaspoonful of soil than there are humans on the planet.
More
so
living
millions,
beings
millions
in that
of
soil.
Microbes.
Oh, my goodness.
So if we don't feed those microbes, and how do we feed the microbes? Well, it's, again, many of our ecologists, going back to Sir Albert Howard, referred to what they called the law of return. So instead of the law of the minimum, it was the law of return. How do you return, the waste, which becomes the food for the microbes, which then restores the health
of the soil?
So
they need a little more than the NKP.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, well, the return is all of the, it would be your animal manure, it would be the straw and the plant materials, all of that goes back into the soil.
Yeah, learning how nature works, that would happen in a forest without being plowed, things get regenerated.
Yeah.
We have to learn how to live with that, not against it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is what the law of return is all about. Nature functions on the basis of self-renewing capacity. If you are paying attention to the microbes in the soil, and you provide them what they need in order to feed themselves, and then they take that material and they enrich the soil. And so it's a self-renewing process. And this is why I like the term that David Montgomery uses about bringing soil back to life. I mean, that's really the focus that we have to be thinking about for the future.
Well, it would seem, since a farmer's biggest asset is his land, which is his soil, land is soil, really.
Yeah.
That the management of that soil, of that major, major asset, would be incumbent as a good business person, farmer, to manage the health of the soil.
Yeah, but again, if you think about, the two cultures that we've been operating in now, going back to the history we've just talked about, so you have the one culture which the farmers have to
control management,
our Secretary of Agriculture said they had to get bigger, get out. They had to farm fence row to fence row. And how do you do that? You push the pedal to the metal a little harder. You force nature to do what you want her to do in order to increase. And it was all about yield. And it was all about, the size of the operation of your farm. But now we're beginning to recognize that all of the resources that we've been using in order to do that are becoming depleted, and so and the costs therefore are going up, and so that's what's getting to a point now where it's just not. And then, you know, you're mentioning the, you know, the loss of soil and the loss of the health of the soil, and so that, you know, means you have to use more inputs. That increases costs. So we're at a point now where, especially as these non-renewable resources get depleted, where we have to pay attention to the self-renewing capacity.
And, now this is what you're calling adaptive management?
Well, it's really adaptive management is really instead of you know, trying to force nature to do what you want nature to do, you learn from nature. You pay attention to nature. And if you do that, then, you know, you manage nature in a way that it causes its self-renewing capacity.
So in Iowa, when our water systems are heavily polluted, when our soil loss is going, you know, I mean, soil is what we have in Iowa, lots of rich soil. And when we are losing that and the, you know, we have a lot of water in Iowa, but it's not very clean anymore. Yeah. So those are signs that maybe something we're doing is not right.
Well,
it's not working.
I think that's true. And certainly I think anybody that's paying attention needs to understand that in Iowa, water quality is something we're simply going to have to deal with. We can't just say, well, you know, they can deal with that another time or
they can deal with it in Des Moines, right?
Yeah, because even water that farmers want to drink from their own wells in some instances now are no longer safe to drink. So, but again, the important thing that we have to recognize here, I think, is that we have created this culture, you know, and the other thing that's important from my perspective, at least, to recognize is the age of our farmers. You know, almost half of our farmers now are over age 60.
Especially in Iowa.
Right. About 35% are over age 70, and only 6% are under age 35. So as the farmers who are in their 60s and 70s retire, you know, we're going to have a huge gap in terms of farmer capacity to farm our land, even to farm it badly. So we have to begin to address this transition that we have to go through now, and the transition is going to be not only moving in the direction that Chuck talks about in his paper, although that's a beginning, but also this, we have to move into this transition where we recognize that we need to learn from nature now. We need to look at the self-renewing capacity. Again, there have been a number of authors that have written about this, and one who wrote a book called How to Thrive in the Next Economy. And he points out in his book that there are now already economies emerging around the world where people are recognizing that this industrial economy, which is not just about agriculture, it's about the whole economy, just is not functioning anymore. And so they, instead of producing one thing in one place.
Certainly not for everyone's benefit, it's not functioning.
Instead of producing just one thing in one place and then selling it throughout the world and importing the things that you need, it's not working for them anymore. So they are now starting to look at their own, what they call their own bioregions, and what are the ecological resources that they have in their own bioregions. And then here's the important part. How can they use those resources in a way that they get renewed in the process of using them? That becomes the self-renewing kind of system. Now, you know, it's going to take some time, you know, for all of us humans on the planet, you know, to adopt this new culture. But eventually we're going to have to do it because the continuing to do what we've been doing is just not going to work anymore.
Yes, to be a farmer, I have a very small farm, you always have to learn new things, but you always have to be aware of what you're dealing with. I have made a lot of mistakes, and I've hoped I've learned from my mistakes.
Yeah.
You can't just keep throwing things at a problem, throwing money at a problem does not fix it very well. you have to realize what you're dealing with. Sure. The idea we can't go on being takers all the time. Yeah. We have to realize we're part of something bigger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And again, this is Leopold's notion that, you know, one of the other great ideas he had, he said that we were not the conquerors of the land community. By land community, again, he meant the entire biological system. We are not the conquerors of the land community. We're simply plain members and citizens.
And I think we somehow think that that is that's not so good, getting along, cooperate. We want to be on top of the heap. We want to be the winner.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's something very powerful about being part of something so powerful as the earth and a soil and a system that works. Yeah. It's kind of hard to be part it's hard to be proud to be on top of a heap that isn't working.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, you know, and I know this from my own experience and I know it from other farmers like yourself who've gone through this, is that once you experience the richness of actually seeing yourself as part of the soil in your farm, you know, it enriches your whole life. I mean, it really does.
Yeah, it really is not about it's not about all the money that you make at farm. That's kind of an oxymoron, all the money you make at farming. But there's something amazing to be part of a farm, part of a growing thing, even part of something growing in your backyard. It's an amazing, amazing.
And to see the life of the soil, you know, and how that self-renewing capacity within the soil, you know, where you don't have to dominate everything, you're really a part of it, you know, and it's a spiritually enriching experience.
Well, I've said this before on the show many, many times. The human species, we're pretty smart about some things. You know, we can send a man to the moon, right? That's a pretty complicated technological feat. However, we still do not understand how human digestion works, nor do we understand and have not even discovered most of the microbiology within our own intestinal systems or within the soil, which is kind of like the intestinal systems of the earth. There's a lot we don't know. A lot we don't know.
Well, I would argue that, in fact, it is known, but not. It's not a part of our culture. You know, I mean, there are healthcare professionals now, there's a number of them that are now. They're now saying that the best way that they can be effective healthcare professionals is by putting people on a diet from food that's grown on healthy soil.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that soil health and human health connection. And one of the reasons that they're excited, that the healthcare professionals are excited about doing that, is because this reduces the cost of healthcare. Because it's not, you don't have to come in with, you know, pharmaceuticals every week, you know, which are getting more expensive. You simply put them on a diet of whole food from healthy soil.
There seems to be a parallel hill between non-renewable resources put on as fertilizer or drugs.
Junk food.
That too. I want to remind folks, this is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Yes, it is. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Fred Kirschman about
food systems, growing food, planetary wisdom.
I want to ask a bit more, but we're talking about the technological fixes that we have inflicted on our planet and ourselves.
Some of them are good, but not all of them.
Not all of them are good. What about, you mentioned early in the show, this technology called CRISPR, which is like fooling around with genes. Do we know enough about
things? Okay, so here are my concerns back to the wired magazine headline, "The Mutant Future of Food Looks Great, Tastes Fine, and Might Just Save the Planet." Well, it also might not. That's might. We really don't know. So some of the problems, you know, and you will all be reading about CRISPR this and CRISPR that and how wonderful it is and da-da-da. Please take that with a grain of salt because some other things are coming along. One of the things that we're discovering as more and more CRISPR things are being put into our plates and other places medically and is that when we alter one of – turn on or off a gene in the DNA, sometimes, oopsie, it affects another place on the DNA that we had not – anticipated. So my personal dilemma with CRISPR and other technologies is we are releasing these into consumer applications, which means things that affect all of us, things that we eat, into medicines and things like that. And we still don't quite have a handle on this technology. We are not pursuing the precautionary principle, which means kind of Fred, tell us about the precautionary principle.
Well, the precautionary principle is that basically that you should use caution as you introduce a new technology and try to understand what its potential impact might be before you
right.
implement it or before you
so,
use it.
So with CRISPR, we have not worked out all the bugs in this technology yet. That we kind of latched onto a big idea that is – I think at this point, a little bit beyond our human comprehension, but, you know, we're so gung-ho on it, and the possibilities, of course, are very exciting, and as well as are the possibilities for making lots and lots of money for certain people. And it's, you know, just hold on there, folks. Yeah. Be a little skeptical.
There again, you know, if we look at the information just this month, a new article came out in the journal Nature Biotechnology, which pointed out, you know, some of the problems that we're starting to see with CRISPR technology mm-hmm. now that nobody anticipated before.
Nobody anticipated before.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that, from my point of view at least, that nobody anticipated that is because, again, you think you can simply introduce a technology into something for a reductionist effect, just one kind of effect. But any time that you're introducing it into living systems, mm-hmm. you know, there are all kinds of other things that happen, and that's exactly what's starting to happen in the CRISPR.
Right, so CRISPR is tinkering with a lot of DNA stuff, which is very, very complicated. Even for people who are experts at it, there are a lot of things we don't know about it.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that you say that there are some quite a few folks that are wising up to this. You talk about communities around the world, individual farmers that are discovering that they're dealing with a whole system,
yeah.
not just a
yeah.
blank slate.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the thing that, you know, and again, unfortunate that we didn't recognize when these other technologies that I mentioned earlier, as they evolved, we didn't recognize that we're dealing with living systems and that we have to look at the impact of and the reactions with a whole living system rather than this reductionist approach, which most of our science, you know, started to do with our technological approaches, where you simply, you know, you got one pest problem and you come in with one pesticide to get rid of it, right? And then you solve the problem. And you're not looking at the whole living system, which it encapsulates that. And if you start looking at the whole living system, then this doesn't mean you should never introduce a technology. But when you do, you try to look at what its impact is in terms of the whole system and whether or not that actually then helps you move toward a solution in the problem or whether, in fact, it can be adding to the problem in the long term.
That seems like it's much better science to do it that way too.
Oh, absolutely. But again, this is why, you know, this is why I mentioned, you know, the science, you know, going back to René Descartes and Francis Bacon, where, you know, they tried to, they had this notion that we were in control, we were in charge, and we could force nature to do what we wanted her to do. And then you tended to, the science tended to move in a reductionist kind of an approach. So you started to look at isolated problems, and how do you then come in with the solution to solve that isolated problem, not recognizing that that isolated problem was part of a living, complex system.
And I would say with all genetic technologies, you have to know that DNA is, you know, there are discrete genes on those strands, but they are all part of a very complex system, which we are only beginning to explore and to begin tinkering with them before we understand how one gene in one position might affect something way down the line. We just don't know yet.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. And also the fact that DNA, the purpose of it is change, to make us be better. I mean, genetic change is a good thing.
Yeah, but it's when nature's running that evolution.
I think they probably know a bit more. Nature does a bit more than us. We'll
nature bats last, remember?
We'll get there. Thank you for being with us, Fred.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Very. We've been talking to Fred Kirchman, and he's been talking about food and agriculture and mistakes that we've made, and maybe we are wise enough to learn new things. Very good. I want to mention there's something nice coming up. The Ames Farmers Market and Aunt Maud's Restaurant is hosting a farm-to-table dinner, and this is kind of the first one on Main Street. We haven't had one of these here. Farm-to-table dinner, Sunday, August 12th, from 5:30 to 9 p.m. There's 150 tickets available, and they are going fast, yes. The whole project has 6,820 likes on Facebook so far.
Oh, boy.
So we're going to find out
what the menu is and talk about it here. I am very curious.
Yeah. The idea of celebrating local food, getting together and
having a big long table down Main Street. I'm just curious about this.
That's one way to remind ourselves that, yes, we're all part of something bigger. The community. The community is a really, really good thing. Yeah. Yes. So for more information on that, you can go to ameschamber.com. And look up the farm to table. Yes.
You know, if we have time for one other comment the comment is made, always part of something bigger. And in fact, I brought my copy of one of the books that came out just a little over a year ago by Brian Swim and Mary Evelyn Tucker called Journey of the Universe. And they point out that we humans on this tiny planet Earth, in this little universe that we're a part of, are part of a much larger cosmos, which has been evolving for 14 billion years. And so at the end they say, so if we think we're still in control when this evolution of the 14 billion years that's been going on in the larger cosmos of which we're a part is going to keep going on, if we think we're in control, we're really deluding ourselves.
We are not. That either scares the living whatever out of you, or you can say, oh, I'm part of something that big.
Yeah.
What a good idea. That's great. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking to Fred Kirchman today. Oh, yes. It was a good discussion, Donna. That's good. Next week, like you said, we're going to find out more about that farm to table, and we're going to find out more about Practical Farmers of Iowa field days that are still going on. So to find out more about Practical Farmers field days, you can go to practicalfarmers.org. Yes. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We had music today by Ross Demerigue, Tidal Wave, yes, some French-Canadian tunes. Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen Tuesday live at noon, repeated Tuesday at 7 p.m., or any time. You can get downloads and archive copies of this show and many more at khoifm.org. This is Community Radio. Thanks for your support. Listen, donate, contribute. Thanks to Fred Kirchman. Support this fine station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Colin Bursack. Eat good food and enjoy life.